you know, sometimes it's sort of just a question of, you know, you can't think of your opening. And you kind of think, oh, God, I've wasted 15 minutes of 2 hours. Yeah, that's an eighth of the thing, and I haven't written a word. Help!
Welcome back to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. My guest this week is the journalist John Crace. John is probably best known now as The Guardian's political sketch writer, commenting on goings-on in Parliament 4 times a week. He also writes a personal diary piece every Saturday known as Digested Week, and he used to do something called the Digested Read for The Guardian, which was a very funny weekly column in which he would give you the gist of a new book in a few paragraphs. He's also published several books of his own, including his new collection of Guardian columns, A Farewell to Calm, which is out next week. I interviewed John in early September at the top of the house he shares with his wife in South London. It's an endearingly cluttered home with lots of pets wandering around, a couple of big collectors of ceramics, and as John mentions, he also collects first editions, so it's a house that's packed with pots and books, among other things. He does his writing in an attic room, which is lined with bookshelves down one wall and with framed pictures and mementos over pretty much every other available space. It's not tidy, but it is lovely, and going in there gave me a sense of all the things that are really important to John and everything he loves in life, so it was a really lovely place to sit and talk. When we met up, John was about to return to The Guardian after a period of sick leave due to depression and anxiety. He's suffered with that throughout his adult life, and he's written about it in The Guardian as well as speaking about it very openly. I knew already when I went to meet him that he had been missed very much by his readers over the summer, because several of his readers are in my own family and they all were very keen to tell me how much they love his writing and how much it cheers them up. When he did go back to work, which was the week after we met, I could see from just the response on Twitter how very well loved he is by so many people, not just his friends, but also thousands of strangers who feel that they know him through his writing. There's something about John that's very open-hearted and warm and kind, and I think even if political writing isn't your usual interest, I hope that you'll enjoy this episode. John talked about how a parliamentary sketch comes together, what it was like to step into the very big shoes of the late journalist Simon Hoggart, and how to reconcile anxiety with a job that involves being constantly plugged into the news. So, over to John. So, thank you for letting me come up into your study. I feel quite honoured, especially as you normally only have one chair.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yes, it's not a very welcoming study.
No, it's very welcoming, actually. It's got a really nice, cosy feel to it. Would you describe it a little bit?
Well, it's basically, in my ideal world, it would be like a library up here. Have all my kind of favourite books, but I can't actually. I've got more books than I've got shelf space for, and I've got photos and illustrations up on the walls, which I'm loath to take down, because I used to do a column in the paper called The Digested Read.
Of course.
And these are all illustrations that I particularly enjoyed from that, and the illustrator gave them to me.
Would you just run through a couple of them for people listening?
Well, this is obviously sort of Stephen Fry's memoirs. That was Keith Richards' memoirs. These sort of more classical ones were from the Digested Classics, which I did for the Digested 20th Century. Yeah, that was Lord Snowden's biography. That was a Rachel Cusk.
I feel like people listening at home are missing out on this, because they are very funny, a lot of these, but maybe it's better if they go and Google the original column. Yeah. So you've also got, proudly, a picture of you on University Challenge.
Yes, I have. I got invited at Christmas. They sort of round up alumni who have made it into public consciousness just about. And a while ago, and I watch University Challenge every week.
Do you?
Yeah.
How did you do when you were on it? Because I just find it so difficult. I can't imagine how people know the answers.
Well, I was terrible.
I'm sure you weren't.
I mean, it was really embarrassing. Because the other team, we were playing against Glasgow, and Glasgow had one person who was just so fast on the buzzer. Because there were times when I kind of knew the answer, but I just didn't press in time. And at one stage, we were sort of 105-10. We were sort of losing and sort of facing abject humiliation. So me and John O'Farrell decided, I think, that we were just going to press the button if we felt like we had the right answer. And we managed to claw our way up to 125 points in the end, but we still lost.
That's respectable.
Yeah, so we didn't totally embarrass ourselves.
Good. That's a good strategy. So, I mean, you do have a lot of books in here. Mm. Is there any sort of rhyme or reason to which ones are in here and which ones are elsewhere?
These are all my old ones, basically, sort of first edition sort of line that have been sort of I've collected over the years. Rather than having a pension, I've sort of collected books, really.
Do you not have a pension?
Not a very good one.
That makes me feel better, because neither do I. You've got some lovely, are these first editions?
Yeah.
You've got some lovely ones. Are they? Mm. When did you start collecting those?
About 20 years ago. Mm. And, you know, just sort of collect here and there from, you know, old book fairs, online auctions, that kind of thing.
Are there any that you're particularly pleased with?
Yes. Where is... where's the one that I've written? Yeah. This one. This is the Bell Jar.
Oh, wow.
But it was obviously Sylvia Plath, but it was originally published under a pseudonym of Victoria Lucas.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, my God. I feel like I should be wearing gloves. That's beautiful.
No, I love that book.
Were you a bit horrified when I put my cup of tea here on the shelf with all your valuable books?
I tried to restrain myself, Hattie. Try to not appear too controlling.
So what else? What are all these folders under here?
Those folders were my cuttings.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Back in the day, you know, from the early 90s when I started my journalism career. But since everything is digital now, I don't really bother. I don't keep my cuttings anymore. I haven't kept them for a while. So that's just sort of historical evidence that I achieved something, I think, really.
It's very hefty as well. And what else? What are these medals?
Those are my dad's medals, and those are my granddad's medals. I couldn't tell you what they all are, because I don't know. I mean, most of them are campaign medals. I do know that one is a gallantry medal that my dad got when his boat was sunk in the Second World War.
God, that's amazing. Mm. There's so much in here that we could talk about. I don't know where to stop. You've got cuddly toys all over the windowsill.
Yeah, those were my son's. Because he used to have a thing about monkeys. And he's now 25 and not really interested in cuddly toys. And I couldn't bear to sort of throw them out or to give them away. So I've got all his old monkey teddies sort of lining up against the door, against the window.
They're lovely. Hmm. And what about these ceramics? Where did they come from? These beautiful bowls.
We got downstairs as well. That's the other thing. That's another passion of mine. Well, my wife makes ceramics anyway, and I became interested through her involvement. And So, you know, at birthdays and Christmas, we give each other bowls, really.
That's lovely. I thought I might have seen a potter's wheel on the way upstairs.
Yeah,
is
you
right
did.
About that?
You
yeah.
did. Yeah, that's Jill's studio. Yeah. That used to be our son's bedroom. But since he left home,
it's dedicated to
yeah, it's pottery. Dedicated to pottery. Yeah. Our daughter's bedroom is still just about intact because she would be furious, even though she's now in America.
How much time do you spend up here?
When I'm working, it's really hard to kind of give an exact figure because when Parliament, before the pandemic, I would go into Westminster every day, and the Guardian has an office, like all the newspapers, has an office in, you know, the Houses of Parliament. And, you know, I've got my sort of desk there. So I would write the sketch from there. Since the pandemic came and we've been working from home, basically. And so I will alternate between sort of watching it on the TV downstairs because I sort of want to sort of watch on a big screen to sort of get as much of the kind of feel and sort of immerse myself in what's happening as possible. And then sort of beetle up here to write, basically.
Yeah. Was there a benefit to being in Westminster? Do you feel you're missing out for not being on site?
Very much so.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it in terms of kind of gossip on the corridors, or what is the benefit of being on site?
I think it's twofold. One is precisely what you say, the gossip on the corridors and just being with the rest of the Guardian team there, and being able to, you know, check out, well, has what I think's just happened just happened. And the other thing is that, you know, obviously when you're in the press gallery, you can look wherever you like. So you can kind of see keep an eye on things and might see things that don't normally the TV cameras miss.
Mm. What, like somebody asleep or?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or if there is a sort of disturbance going on or something like that.
Yeah. When do you think you'll get back in there?
Well, I'm going back into work. I'm starting work again next week. And my plan is to go in next Wednesday for PMQs.
Right.
So, scary.
Quite exciting, though.
Yeah.
So you've had a bit of time off recently, but have you been writing anything recently, or have you taken a bit of a break from that as well?
No, I've taken a break. I haven't been writing. I'm under contract to write two books.
Oh, gosh.
But I haven't really made much progress there. So perhaps we should skate over that.
I was going to say, can you tell me what they're going to be? But maybe it's too early.
Well, one was going to be a novel. The other was going to be a memoir.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
When do you first remember writing being something that was important to you?
Well, I mean, for the basically, I got into writing almost by accident. What had happened was that throughout my 20s, I'd been a heroin addict, and you know, I didn't really have a job, or I didn't really, you know, I had sort of, you know, worked in a bookshop here, in a sort of coffee bar here, or there, and sold insurance, and I mean, it was just sort of a rackety, raggedy life. And I cleaned up when I was 30, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was taken in, or I needed somewhere to live. And I was taken in by another writer. He had a spare room in his house, in his flat rather, and so I sort of moved in there, and I don't know, I kind of sort of watched him work and watched him write, and I kind of thought, actually, maybe this is something I could do, because I read some of the things that, I mean, I'd always thought there was this great, that it would have to be absolutely brilliant to be published. And I didn't realise that all I had to do was just sort of be good enough. And I mean, I also kind of, it was sort of back in the late 80s, early 90s. And print journalism was really booming then. And so there was a lot of work for freelance journalists. And so I kind of thought, okay, there is an opening, and no one is also going to ask for a CV. I mean, I've never been asked for a CV in my life, really, which is sort of just as well.
I think it'd be quite good now, probably.
Might get away with it now. But, you know, well, certainly not when I was 30. You know, I had huge holes and years sort of completely unexplained. But no one bothered, because all the, you know, all it was, you know, I mean, I wrote my first few pieces on spec, because, you know, the commissioning editors said, well, we don't know who you are, so, but if you'd like to write on spec, and I think I got lucky. My work got published, and once you've been published by one newspaper, other newspapers sort of think, oh, well, you can't be totally crap. So it's sort of a kind of knock on effect.
Yeah. Do you remember what your first byline was?
I do. And I mean, I also think that, do you know there's a novelist called Jim Crace?
Yes.
And I think that the commissioning editor might have confused and thought that she was getting something from Jim Crace.
Thanks, Jim.
I owe Jim my career.
Was it for The Guardian, the first
piece?
No,
it was for The Independent on Sunday.
Okay.
I mean, literally, I'd heard this feature on the radio, Radio 4, in the afternoon, about a self-help group called Aftermath, which is a charity for family and friends of violent criminals. So it was for people whose sons, parents, girlfriends, boyfriends were rapists, murderers, whatever. And, you know, how they learnt, you know, how they managed to sort of cope with having someone who they'd loved, you know, be convicted for sort of such terrible crimes. And I thought, this will make a great piece for the and the Sunday Independent agreed. But I do think they thought that I was Jim Crace, because the next time I wrote for them and approached them, they said, yes, we'll definitely take it, but we're going to pay you half what we paid you last time. So that made me think that maybe they thought they had to pay over the odds for Jim.
Did you feel that you already had a sort of some sort of innate understanding of what an article should be in terms of the structure and all of that stuff? Or did it take you a while to kind of get the hang of that? It's quite impressive, I think, to just approach a newspaper on spec and write a piece like that. Mm. Quite an interesting piece.
No, I think possibly it was just sort of delusion and arrogance on my part, really, that I kind of thought I could do it. I didn't really know if I was doing it right or wrong. I mean, I would get my friend to read my first pieces, just to sort of check, and he just sort of went, oh, yes. I mean, the last thing he wanted to do was to read sort of my musings. But I just sort of learned as I went away. There was a writer, I think it was Will Self, who said that the first 250,000 words you write are going to be rubbish, probably. And after that, you'll probably have an idea of how to write. And the trick is to get paid for the first 250,000.
Yeah, to get you over that threshold. To get you
over the threshold so that you know what you're doing.
Until you're actually deserving the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at what point did you become sort of regularly at The Guardian? Or are you on staff at The Guardian?
I am, yeah. Well, I got in sort of... I started writing for the education section. That was back in the day. And, I mean, I took a very commercial view to my writing because, I mean, I like a lot of people, I mean, I had fantasies, I think, of sort of writing G2 cover stories, you know, and that was going to be the way that I would go. But I quickly realised that that was a really competitive market and they weren't going to kind of throw that kind of opportunity out. But... with the education section, the bar was a bit lower because a lot of staff, you know, Guardian staffers didn't want to write for the education. They didn't have the time. So there was this pool of work available so I could earn a living and sort of learn how to write, really, writing for the education supplement. So I started off with them writing freelance. And then they invited me in to have a desk. And so I was in this weird situation where I was completely freelance, but I had a pass and a desk. And then I got put on a yearly contract. And then I became, then I in sort of 2004, 2005, I was put on staff.
Right, okay. So you've been staff for coming up to 20 years.
Yeah.
And when did you start doing the parliamentary sketches?
2014.
Okay, so that's been your sort of main
thing
since then. And you do that Monday to Thursday.
Yeah.
And then a diary piece for Saturday.
Yeah.
It's quite a demanding job. Would you talk me through, on a day that you're doing a parliamentary sketch, how does that come together from kind of waking up in the morning to filing the copy?
I mean, I'm... always got a vague idea of what I mean. To an extent, you're at the sort of mercy of the parliamentary timetable, so things can get. I mean, it's got to be something that is either you know, a politician making a speech or an urgent question or a parliamentary statement from a minister, generally. But I will start in the morning by, I mean, I read the morning email. There's loads of organisations, Politico, The Times, they send out morning emails of, you know, the agenda for the day. And so you can sort of guess. I mean, next Monday will be the first day back after recess. So... I would have thought it was almost inevitable there's going to be an urgent question or a statement on Afghanistan. So I will have spent, you know, some time in the morning sort of doing my homework on, you know, who's likely to come up. You know, right now, I don't know who it will be, whether it'll be Boris Johnson himself, you know, giving the statement, or Dominic Raab again. And, you know, I just think about the sort of psychodynamics of, you know, what kind of pressure are the politicians under? What are the issues they're trying to get across? And what are the issues they're trying to avoid, really? Because I often feel a lot of the sketch is about uncovering the holes in all the duplicity or the doublethink, really. I mean, it struck me, I mean, during Dominic Raab's appearance before the Select Committee yesterday, that was on Wednesday, it seemed to me that on the one hand he was saying that he'd been utterly prepared for the Taliban takeover. And then in the next sentence, he was saying he was taken completely by surprise. And no one really seemed to pick him up on that. And so, I, you know, had I been writing a sketch of that, that's what I would have gone in on, really. Mm. I would have kind of had fun and saw all the other things that he might have forgotten.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, your job is really, you're one of the people who's holding politicians accountable. So it does rely on you having a pretty good attention to detail in terms of what they've said previously and where they might be contradicting themselves and the promises that have been made that haven't actually been delivered.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been off for a little bit, but have you been keeping a very close eye on what's going on?
Yeah, very much so. It's sort of hard not to. It's sort of no secret that you know, I suffer from mental health problems. So, I mean, I have been off with anxiety and depression, most of which sort of coincided with the parliamentary, in, you know, 6 weeks of parliamentary recess, which, you know, was... So I haven't had to miss too much work. But, you know, it is... There is something quite addictive about the parliamentary kind of cut and thrust and the way, I mean, and also, you know, there's a kind of part of me that feels like, you know, if I miss, say, if I take my eye off it for a week or something, then I will miss some key part of the story that will come back to bite me. Because there's always this feeling that I need to know enough to make the sketch credible, yeah. Really.
You need to sound as though you are fully across the situation.
Yeah. I mean, you get a bit of leeway with the parliamentary sketch because humour and satire, you can use exaggeration and, you know, hyperbole. But... sorry, that was the dog.
That's okay.
But you know, there has to be a truth in there that and people have to believe that you know what you're doing, that you're sort of being fair to your targets as well. Mm. I think.
I've been reading your new collection, A Farewell to Calm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it really focuses on the pandemic and politics during the pandemic, and rereading it sort of reminded me of what an extremely difficult and stressful year 2020 was for everyone. Mm. I think a lot of people who are, you know, interested in the news go through periods where they have to switch off because, you know, it's not unusual to find people saying that the news has not been good for their mental health. And I certainly last year, I think quite early on in the pandemic, I switched off the news alerts on my phone because they were just filling me with anxiety every time they popped up. You can't really do that. Does it affect your mental health, do you think?
I mean, undoubtedly is the simple answer. And I think, you know, it has. I think, you know, the anxiety and depressive episode that I've just had, I think, you know, I mean, being exposed to the news, it's not just being exposed to the news, though. It's being exposed to the incompetence and the mendacity of the politicians as well at the same time, you know, and just this feeling that, you know, you're stuck in the eye of the storm somewhere and you've got to sort of, you know, I mean, it has been an awful last 18 months. And I mean, we're in a kind of weird period now, sort of like a lacuna, whereby it's almost as if the government is trying to pretend that COVID isn't a problem anymore. When all the figures rather suggests that it is, and that, you know, the schools are about to go back. We all, you know, everybody seems to know that the numbers are going to go up again. But it's almost as though the government has decided that it can't shut down again. And if it can't shut down again, it just doesn't want to talk about it.
So how do you manage that? Or how are you planning to manage it as you return back to work, you know, to protect yourself from being too bogged down with that?
I think, you know, just sort of try and keep up with going to football, going to... I love the opera as well. Going to opera and seeing friends, really. And I'm not sure if there is a way that I can necessarily guarantee that I kind of escape unscathed again.
I was going to ask, actually, because you've also written books about cricket. You wrote a book about cricket, didn't you? And a couple about football.
Yeah.
And for a long time, you did the digested read in The Guardian, which was a sort of almost literary satire kind of thing, wasn't it? And I wondered if you think fondly back on that sort of work, which maybe was less stressful. Do you ever think, oh, I'd like to go back, you know, I'd like to go and write another book about football, or I'd like to go back to doing something in the arts?
Yes and no, really. I mean, it's quite nice not having to write about the arts in a way, because that keeps my, you know, it keeps them intact. I mean, when I was doing the digested read, I think it sort of changed the way I read books, because I was sort of reading, rather than just reading for enjoyment, I was reading to look for how the book was written, how it was kind of put together, you know, what were its strengths, what were its weaknesses, and sort of looking for things to parody and to satirise, if you like. And it's quite nice now just to be able to kind of pick up a book and not feel like I've got to generate copy out of it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, I do, yeah, part of me does miss it as well. I really enjoyed doing the digested read.
Yeah.
I mean, because I did it for almost 20 years. Which is incredible, really.
Maybe you could revive it, having had a bit of a break. Well, I think people would be very happy to see it back. Mm.
And also, I did kind of get to... I mean, one of the weird things is, you know, having written a lot of books myself now and having, you know, been sort of to loads of literary festivals over the years... I mean, a lot of writers have become friends, and I found it's. I was going soft.
You didn't want to satirise books of people who you might like, or
yeah, exactly.
might be about to meet, or yeah,
exactly. I mean, because, you know, by and large, I really like writers. I like their company, and you kind of think when you're sort of satirising. Sort of politicians that, I mean, they are making decisions on behalf of the whole country. I mean, you know, satirizing a writer for writing a book that wasn't quite as good as their last one did feel a bit petty after a while.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I think that's also, I think I wasn't a particularly good book critic, because at the back of my mind all the time, I had this voice that was going, they've done really well to write a book, though, and it's a lot of work, and you know, I haven't managed it, and so then it did feel, I did struggle a bit with then saying this didn't really work. Anyway, speaking of too soft, I think a lot of Guardian readers, and I speak having discussed that I was doing this interview with some of my family. See your column almost as a sort of public service. I think you do bring a lot of comfort to people, and I think you perhaps help them to sort of find a focal point for the frustration that they have with the government. Do you hear a lot from readers?
I do. One of the lovely things has been sort of while I've been off, the, you know, various readers have sort of apparently been phoning the switchboard saying sort of, where's John?
Oh, that's and nice.
I've had emails from various people as well. And sort of various sort of people on Twitter have said, are you okay? Sadly not. But I mean, I'm kind of flattered that sort of people have sort of taken the sketch to heart, really. I mean, I really didn't know what I was doing when I sort of took it on. When I took it on, the previous person, Simon Hoggart, had been doing it for 20 years. And for some, you know, I just assumed that he would carry on indefinitely. But sadly, he got very ill and died. And I was sort of asked to take over from him. And I kind of thought, well, how do you take over from some, you know, an institution like Simon Hoggart? And I thought the only thing that I can do is to just sort of try and write it my way. You know, don't try and be a sort of imitation of Simon. So Simon always used to have one of his pet targets that he would, you know, politicians that he loved to sort of have a go at was Michael Fabricant, who's got a ridiculous sort of orange wig. And I thought, what I'll do is I will retire Michael Fabricant. My sort of bit for Simon would be to retire Michael Fabricant from the sketch. And after I'd been doing it for about a year, I did get a politician tap me on the shoulder and say, Michael Fabricant's very concerned that he's not in the sketch anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you put him back in after that or no?
I think maybe I have. He did maybe
once or twice. Perhaps.
Once or twice, but definitely my default position is that he is sort of written out. But it did make me realise that sort of, I would have thought most backbenchers would be keen not to feature in the sketch, but it made me realize that some of them, their ego was so big that they would rather be in and have somebody making fun of them rather than to be ignored.
Better to be ridiculed than to be irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure that is actually a good philosophy for life, but
no, I don't think so. It's not a trade-off I would make.
Rereading your columns from last year, I sort of had this realization that I think with politics, we often have the sense that things are sort of nearing a breaking point or a climax of some kind, and you know, suddenly somebody's going to be sacked or they're going to realize that they can't continue to do things in the way that they've been doing things. And then actually, I think what more often happens is that one drama is just sort of superseded by another drama, and some of these things kind of get forgotten. I mean, I think Boris, a little bit like Trump, does this thing of, if he doesn't admit that he's cocked anything up, then we never have, you know, he can just continue to cock things up indefinitely and there's no sort of consequences. There was a line that I wrote down in one of your sketches which said, disaster has become the new normal, so when things are no worse than they were the day before, it almost feels as if a corner has been turned. And I thought, there's something slightly frustrating about that. Does it drive you mad as a sort of political commentator that things just keep ticking along in this way and people don't always get the kind of comeuppance or the breaking point that we're hoping for?
Well, I mean, it's trying to kind of predict anything in politics is always a bit of a nightmare, really. You know, a lot of people were, you know, I mean, all through the early days of the pandemic, you know, there was sort of, you know, Matt Hancock would sort of get it in the neck. And, you know, none of us had a clue, or, well, I certainly didn't, that he was having this affair and that, you know, he was about to become...
Yeah, that would be his downfall.
That would be his downfall, that, you know, having told everybody that they should must social distance, you know, he'd been breaking his own rules.
What would you say you're striving for as a writer? Do you think there's any sort of through line in the writing that you've done through your career and how you approach it?
I mean, to tell the truth, really, and to do it in a way that is sort of fun and entertaining. I mean, the sketch has always got to be entertaining, but I think it should be more than that as well. You know, there should be sort of, great sort of traditions of sort of satire. I mean, that they should be holding politicians to account. So I would like to think it does that. And just to not be boring, really. I think if the sketch is boring, then that's its worst failing of all.
Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
It's always the kind of pressure of deadlines, really. I mean, by and large, one would always like more time. You know, because The Guardian, my sketch goes up online on the night that I write it. But it also, I have to work to a print deadline as well, because it appears in the newspaper the next day. So, if there's a late press conference, like during the coronavirus pandemic, when it was full on
nightmare.
Yeah. There would be a 5 o'clock press conference, and which would probably go on for about 45 minutes. And then I'd have to write sort of 750, 800 words before 7:30. So, you've got to kind of distill the press conference. You've got to make sure that you've got the right kind of themes and then try and be funny about it at the same time. And, I could often feel my sort of heart racing and sort of kind of panic. I've got to write, help.
Got 20 minutes.
Yeah, or even, sometimes it's just a question of, you can't think of your opening. And you kind of think, oh God, I've wasted 15 minutes of 2 hours. Yeah, that's an eighth of the thing and I haven't written a word. Help!
Openings and closers are, I think, the hardest thing generally. I can never think of a good way to end an article that isn't just completely, smarmy or just flat. It's just really difficult. I do think that newspapers, I worked a lot for kind of websites and magazines before I started writing for The Times. Mm. And writing for The Times was brilliant in just getting me into the discipline of turning something out quickly and letting it go. And, a bit like what you were saying at the beginning about how it doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to be good enough. Mm. That's quite important in newspaper writing, I think, because they just don't have time for you to fanny around trying to make it perfect. So it's quite a good skill, I think. Mm. And it can be quite exciting. I mean, do you ever find that quite exciting when you haven't got very long and you've got to try and condense something?
I mean, general election campaigns are sort of famous for it. I mean, I've written numerous sketches on a train station in the middle of nowhere, having been to a UKIP rally sort of miles in a community hall, in sort of miles from a Welsh station. You're wondering how you're going to get back to the station, how you're going to write, how you're going to do everything. And you're just sort of bashing things out.
Can you think of anything that you've learnt over the years that improved your writing?
Well, reading other people, other writers. Not just books. And just keeping going, really.
And looking back at your writing career, what do you feel proudest of?
Well, I mean, it is the sketch, I think. I mean, looking back, I would probably if in 1990 someone had said to me, in 30 years' time you're going to be writing the sketch, I would have thought this is a sort of nonsense. There's only one person who gets to write The Guardian sketch, at any one time. And there's only four newspapers carry a sketch anyway. and three of them probably wouldn't have a person of your politics anyway. So the Guardian is the only place. So I kind of feel like I've sort of ended up in the sort of best place I could be. You know, and I mean, one of the things I love about the Guardian is that I've never had anyone lean on me to, you know, can you make your sketch a bit more like this? Or, you know, today we want to sort of go, you know, hard on so-and-so. I mean, you get direction, you know, on every morning we'll agree what we're going to do. You know, if there's a UQ on an urgent question on Afghanistan, we'll say, should we do that or should we do COVID? You know, we'll kind of decide which is the most important and the most sort of entertaining session of Parliament to do, or maybe a press conference or something like that. But after that, I'm very much left to do, you know, to interpret it in my own way. And that's a real privilege, I think.
A massive thank you to John Crace. The latest collection of his sketches, A Farewell to Calm, is out next week and can be pre-ordered now. Go to uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing to look at that and his other titles. And I will put that URL in the show notes. I'm also going to put in a few links to John's sketches online, but also to the very moving article he wrote in 2019 about his battle with heroin addiction. He was also a guest on Elizabeth Day's How to Fail podcast, and that was an episode that really stuck with me, so I'm going to add that link too. If you liked this episode, please do just take a minute to share it or send it to someone else who might enjoy it. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week with a wonderful novelist guest.